From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Heidi Kaiser. This is State of Nevada. Well, the growing pains of the Arts District continue. Months after fending off a potential noise ordinance, the burgeoning downtown neighborhood is now contending with rising parking costs. They include price hikes on existing meters, new meters awaiting activation, and once free private lots now charging fees. It seems that whatever free parking remained is now all but gone. Business owners, their employees, and Arts District patrons are furious, if social media and the public comments at city council meetings are any indication. The city says it will meet with the community soon to discuss the issue further, but will it compromise its revenue plan, especially after having to settle the Badlands Golf Course lawsuit to the tune of $286 million. In a moment, we will hear from a statement from Councilwoman Olivia Diaz, whose district includes the Arts District. But first, joining us in studio are two business owners from the area, Scott Gibson from Josephine Scott Hairdressing and Troy Hurd from Majestic Repertory Theater. Scott and Troy, welcome to State of Nevada.
Good morning.
And Scott, I want to start with you. Your salon at Art Square did have a big free lot in front of it, and the streets also had free parking. Then came the announcement that the lot, which is privately owned, would be charging, and meters started popping up all over the streets north of Charleston. As a business owner, what were your initial thoughts when that started happening?
Well, it was a little terrifying at first because we had no warning. They just started popping up. We just saw the meters popping up everywhere. And then our landlord started charging for the lot that was free. And there was no meetings. There was no discussion. And it just happened out of nowhere.
So no one knocked on your door or put a notice? No email?
No, there was nothing.
Like that. And your employees, what was their reaction?
Oh, they're worried about paying these high fees because they already pay to come to work. So the way like a salon works is most of them are booth rental. So all of my employees have to pay to come to work in the first place. Our supplies are going up in expense. And just adding the extra cost of having to park to come to work is a little too much for them.
A little additional expense. And what prices were announced for the private lots near?
So the private lot in front of us is $4 an hour.
And so for a normal day, what is that?
But it does max out at 6 hours. So it's a $24 cap for the day.
So around 25 bucks a day.
Correct.
On top of everything else. So most salons in the Valley do have free parking because the strip malls that they're typically in offer it. Does having potentially no free parking near you, is that a competitive disadvantage? Or do people want to come downtown because of who you are?
People do. Luckily, they do. We have a good reputation, and they do come to see us. And they're traveling from other parts of the city. So those people that live in Summerlin or Henderson that are coming downtown, they could easily go somewhere else closer to them and not pay for parking.
Mm. You were at last week's city council meeting and participated in the public comment portion. After a public comment, Councilwoman Olivia Diaz did make a 5-minute statement. We have a recording of part of that. Here's one part.
The city is committed to exploring solutions such as looking into adding more employee resident parking lots on the north side that are currently lacking, and continue to provide reduced cost parking permits for residents and employees, which we currently have over 700 plus that we have issued to $10 to these 700 community members for $10 a month. We also are looking into how we can partner with private lot owners.
So Scott, you and other public commenters didn't have a chance to respond to Councilwoman Diaz, but if you had, what would you have said? Did she address your concerns?
A little bit, but the thing with the $10 parking, there is permits for employees, business owners to get $10 parking, but there's been a wait list for months and months and months for those $10 permits. Right now, the only available options are the private city lots, and those are about $50 to $60 a month. So the $10 a month, that is just not true right now.
And Troy, I see you had some response. I want to bring you in here also, Troy Hurd of Majestic Repertory Theater. You've had to deal with paid parking near your theater on Main Street south of Charleston for a few years now. I saw you kind of reacting to that statement. What were you going to say there?
Oh, it's difficult. I mean, even when that came about, the slots, they were very hard to get. I think my response to this thing, to Olivia's statement right there, is why is she making the statement after the fact? Why didn't we have this discussion before this was implemented? I mean, there was no communication between the city and the business owners. There's now it's kind of like the noise ordinance. It's all happening, you know, too late with no communication.
And you're fairly proactive in that regard, if I'm not mistaken. You go to these meetings and things.
Absolutely. And that's the important thing. You can comment on Facebook. You can sign a petition. But unless you show face and show up at these meetings, they're not going to listen to us.
And you've noticed a significant difference, if I'm not mistaken, Troy, in patronage mm-hmm. between before the meters were installed and after. Can mm-hmm. you talk about that?
Well, you always hear about people complaining about paying for parking at casinos because that's the Las Vegas culture, is don't pay for parking. It's part of being in the Wild West. Right after the pandemic, when our doors reopened, that's when the first meters went up, and I did see a loss in patronage and a lot of complaints. And I said, you know, tell your councilwoman, tell the councilperson, complain to the city. But now that we've had this jump in the spike in rates, again, without any warning, you know, we're in between shows. We're about to open a show this weekend, and I'm very interested to see, or hopefully, you know, not see a change. Yeah, I've got to get the data coming through, but I'm pretty sure we're going to have some impact because you're not just coming to the theater. You're coming to the theater, you're coming down to eat, you're coming down to walk around, you're coming to have a drink after the show. You're there for 4 to 6 hours, making an event of coming to the Arts District, and that's going to add up quickly.
Yeah, it's a destination. And kind of switching back to you, Scott, speaking of that sort of, you know, destination aspect of it, your salon's been there for 13 years or so. If parking remains too high for your staff and clients, because it's not as much of a destination visit there, do you think you'd be able to keep your spot there?
I mean, that's the hope. Hopefully we can work with the city and get these rates down. I think $4 an hour is just far too high. If you look at someplace LA, if you want to compare cities, compare us to LA, where there's not a good infrastructure for public transportation. Everybody needs a car. You need somewhere to park it. LA, all of the meters on the streets are $1.50 an hour, and they just recently raised that from $1 an hour. And it has not been raised since 2014, but at 2025, they raised it just 50 cents. But we just doubled from $2 an hour to $4 an hour.
So rather than being incremental over a long period of time, it's a lot all at once. And Troy Hurd, I want to come back to you. What are you hearing from other people like Scott in the area on the south side?
Oh, we're just trying to figure. Well, you mentioned the south side. That's something that's been popping up, is this odd arbitrary division between North and South Charleston. Olivia mentioned they're going to change rates north of Charleston, look at things, but we're the 18B Arts District. We are a collective whole. You know, we're not operating individually. You know, we're a group of small business owners. We're not large corporations. We're not sports arenas. You know, we're providing a service to Las Vegas. We are another destination off the strip that people are actively coming to find. You know, I always say we're the true heart of Las Vegas. We're the lost in the Las Vegas, whatever. It's 8 o'clock in the morning. You know, it's time for the community to stand together and show up and be seen and be heard.
And I want to come back to that city council meeting where you spoke. Councilwoman Diaz used her statement to address the responsibilities the city has, since you brought that up, in maintaining the Arts District. And here's what she said.
Growth must pay for growth. As the Arts District has expanded, demands on infrastructure have skyrocketed. We have seen unprecedented needs for street maintenance, improved lighting, safety patrols, sanitation, etc. For years, these costs have been absorbed by the city's general fund, meaning they were subsidized by every taxpayer in the city, regardless of whether they ever visited the district. the model, as our economies, we're all feeling it, are shrinking, will probably no longer be sustainable. Every dollar collected needs to be reinvested back into the area where it's collected from.
So Troy Hurd, coming back to you again, no one got a chance to respond to Councilwoman Diaz at the meeting. So what would you have said in response to that if you had been able to?
Well, my first question would be, is that money coming back to the area? Is that money coming back to the arts district, or is that covering other expenses within the city? And also, I know that we've had, up to this point, we've had discussions of a business improvement district privatizing those services, privatizing sanitation, security, et cetera. If so, then that's definitely going to take the onus off the shoulders of the city and back onto the shoulders of the business owners. So where are we in along those discussions?
So much more to say, but I'm afraid we are going to have to leave it there. We have been talking with Troy Hurd of Majestic Repertory Theater and Scott Gibson of Josephine Scott Hairdressing. Troy and Scott, thank you both so much for being here and talking about this.
Thank you, honey.
Thank you.
. 2026 is an election year, and for many in Nevada, political analysis starts and stops with one name, John Ralston. He's the CEO of the Nevada Independent and also an author. His second book, The Game Changer, comes out next week on January 20th, and it's about another Nevadan who political junkies will definitely recognize, Harry Reid, the late senator for whom the Democratic political force known as the Reid Machine is named, may be the most powerful figure to come from Nevada. He ascended the ranks to Senate Majority Leader and essentially became the right-hand man to former President Barack Obama. Reid is largely credited with getting the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, passed in the U.S. Senate, but his legacy does go far beyond that. For Desert Companion, KNPR's Paul Boger sat down with Ralston in advance of his book release.
John, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Paul.
Before we talk about the book, I want to spend a few minutes talking about you and your career. You know, in all the times you and I have chatted, I realize I don't really know a lot about your career prior to you starting the Indy. You know, let me ask you, when did you first realize you wanted to be a journalist?
I was involved in sports writing when I was at Cornell as an undergrad, and I was at Cornell Daily Sun, and I had a great time, and I thought I wanted to be a sports writer. And then I went to the University of Michigan, got a master's, kind of fell in love with news, and then I got a job, entry-level job, night police reporter at the Las Vegas Review-Journal in 1984, and I thought I'd be out in Vegas. See, I'm from Buffalo, New York, and I thought I'd be out in Vegas for couple of years max on my career path back to the New York Times, and got to cover county government, the Clark County Commission, which that's where my introduction to politics took hold. And there was so much great stuff going on, and I had some great mentors back then who taught me a lot about how it worked. And so I fell in love with politics, and I'll never forget, after I was made the political reporter at the RJ a month before the primary in 1986, I was just thrown into it, and I had the time of my life. And I just remember the editor at the time, a guy by the name of Tom Keevil, calling me into his office and telling me that he's never seen anyone who was born to be in the milieu that I was operating in as I was. So I was hooked, man.
Let's talk about Harry Reid. Tell me about your first time meeting the man.
You know, I've been trying to remember that because a lot of people have asked me that. As I said, I was thrown in to the campaign beat in 1986 in August. I was a month before the primary at the time. The primary was in September. And that was the marquee race. And I was introduced to Reid, and I can't tell you how little I was impressed by him. He seemed very milquetoast and had no personality whatsoever. And I couldn't believe that this guy was in Congress, much less was going to be elected to the U.S. Senate. And boy, did I have him read wrong, Paul.
Who was Harry Reid?
It's a very complicated question. In fact, I hope I tell it pretty well. And I'm almost 400 pages. I don't know how well I captured him and how well I really, really know who he was. Very complicated guy. There's a duality to the guy, some of which I just alluded to, is this guy who came across as very milquetoast and awkward and somewhat gaffe-prone at times in public, but who in private was the consummate deal maker, incredibly ruthless, super insightful and far-thinking in terms of of he knew how to get from point A to point B and where the potholes would be and what moves he could make. His outer appearance belied this inner core of steel and smarts that got him where he was. But he was a complicated guy, Paul. I mean, he was willing to really do incredibly nasty and vicious things to people to get where he was going, or to people who would not follow what he told them to do. But on the other hand, his staff was as loyal to him as any staff I've covered for any elected official. They loved him, revered him even, and he was good to a lot of them in private. One of them, for instance, real quickly, was dyslexic, and her job was to just get phone numbers for him to call back people. And she kept getting the numbers wrong, and she got called in to talk to him, and she thought she was going to get fired. And what he said is, it must have been so hard, much harder for you than other people to get where you are today. I admire that. Just keep trying hard. And he nurtured people in that way. And there were uncommon acts of kindness that he had privately, which really belie how he was like in the political world, where he was ruthless and Machiavellian as anybody I covered.
By the time you were interviewing for him for the book, and nearer the end of his life, you were at least on friendly terms. Would you call it friendly terms, or was it still professional terms?
That's an interesting distinction. I would say friendlier terms, but I had been having people go to him to let me write the book, saying I was the one who knew him best. He had had a book done called The Good Fight that was really just hagiographic, and really he essentially wrote it, and the guy who wrote it loved Reed, clearly, unabashedly. I never even really disliked Reed in the sense that, even though I knew what he was doing to try to make my life more difficult, I knew he saw it just as business. He was doing the right thing. And some of it became a little bit personal because it had to do with me writing stories about what he called his family, what I would see as him trying to do favors for his sons to help them out in his professional capacity. And, of course, his wife, Landra, they have an amazing 62-year love affair. That's an amazing story that I get into a little bit in the book, as you know. But Reed and I had this up-and-down relationship. He wouldn't come on my show for a long time. By the time he left office, though, we were on better terms. But I had no idea he was going to finally agree to the book until he called me one day and summoned me to his office at the Bellagio then, because he went to work for MGM afterwards a little bit. And he basically called me into his office and said, I want to do the book. I know I'm not going to like everything that you write in the book, but don't go after my family and let's get it done. And I was shocked that he had actually agreed to do it, and thrilled, by the way. And so then, unfortunately, Paul, he was already sick by the time I finally was able to get a publisher and start interviewing him. It was May of 2021, and he died 6 months later, a little more than 6 months later. But I still got to do 24 Zoom interviews with him. And I don't know if he would have described it this way, but we kind of formed a bond during these Zooms. They were all at least an hour, some of them closer to two-hour-long interviews. And he was very open and funny and insightful, and his memory was still pretty sharp. I was very, very affected when he died. I was very sad when he died. It felt like someone close to me had died, because we had spent, not only had I spent so much time with him, but interviewing people for the book, going up to his archive at the University of Nevada, Reno, and seeing all these, you know, amazing inside documents, notes he had written, and memos. So I really felt a real personal loss when he died that I didn't think I was going to feel.
Did you admire him? I mean, how do you feel about him?
Very simple answer to whether I admired him. Yes, I admired him. I admired where he came from to get where he got. It's really an astonishing story. One of the reasons I wanted to tell it. I mean, was he a scary figure in the sense that you got the sense that he would do anything up to a certain point? And I'm still not sure if I know, even having been his biographer, what that point was to get where he would do anything to get there. And so I admired that he was willing to do almost anything for a cause that he felt was just. And by that, I mean whether it was a political cause or a friend's cause or for his family, he was willing to go to any lengths to get there. And so I admired, because so many people get power and then don't do anything with it or just want to maintain that power. Harry Reid was always willing to lose a race, and he almost did a couple of times in 98. And 2010 was not as close as people think, but 98, and I raise this in the book, there's still some people who think he lost that race in 98, but some circumstances led him to being declared the victor. And Dean Heller, more than anybody, the Secretary of State, is the Republican, is responsible for Harry Reid's career post-1998. By the way, I'm very disappointed that Heller refused to be interviewed for the book, but maybe he didn't want to tell why he did what he did.
At this point, you know, we live in a post-Harry Reid world, so it's hard to maybe say if there's one specific piece of legislation that has had the biggest impact on the state. What do you think Harry Reid's legislative impact?
I think he is probably proudest of having gotten Obamacare passed. And I think a lot of that has to do with what he had to do to do it. And it was the transactional Harry Reid at his best with his colleagues corralling votes. But it also had to do with the fact that he had no health care when he was a kid. And I think that was a serious and his brother broke his leg, and they didn't have a doctor, and they never set the leg. And his brother had essentially a bent leg for his entire life because of it. Reid remembered those kinds of things, and I think they really affected him. And I think even Harry Reid's critics should acknowledge that what he did to get Obamacare passed was really remarkable, whether you like Obamacare or not. I think he was very proud of his environmental legacy. I think he was very proud of negotiating a compact on the Truckee River that everyone thought was impossible and that Paul Laxalt failed to do. He did a tremendous amount of stuff with public lands that he's very, very proud of, whether it's national monuments or the first national park in Nevada. He was very, very proud of those. And I think he was proud, too, of stopping things. He was very proud of stopping George W. Bush when he was president from privatizing Social Security. He worked with Nancy Pelosi, whom he absolutely adored and was very much like him in her ruthlessness and willing to do anything to get from point A to point B. But I think the number one thing is probably Obamacare.
Harry Reid is also responsible for essentially ending the filibuster for presidential appointments. You've described Reid as not necessarily being somebody who spent a lot of time on self-reflection, on regret, thinking about things he regretted. Do you think he would still stand by that decision to get rid of the filibuster?
Well, I asked him that, and he said no question. He said the only regret he ever had in all of his public life was voting for the Iraq War. He says he thinks it's ludicrous that the Republicans, you know, say give Harry Reid credit for having all of Trump's appointees on the Supreme Court. He says, you know, Mitch McConnell would have done this whether he had actually done it or not, and a lot of people close to him believe that. He is not stung by that at all. The only thing that stung him about that when I talked to him was how Democrats who had voted with him when he first decided to do it in 2013, then were changing their story about whether they were with him or not. They voted for it and then said, oh, this was a terrible move by Harry Reid. And he used to rail on these Zooms about, do they not remember how they voted back then? So he was upset with them trying to rewrite history, essentially. But he had no regrets about doing that. And some people have said, including a good friend of his in the Senate, Richard Shelby, who was a Democrat who became a Republican. Hey, do you guys think that Harry Reid wouldn't have done what Mitch McConnell did if the roles were reversed to try to get three Supreme Court justices? Of course he would have. And I don't think he's wrong.
I do want to touch on Landry because 62-year marriage, you know, she was pivotal to his success in almost every single way. Just how important was she to him?
I knew a lot about Reid before I started researching this book, Paul, but I had no idea just how important she was and how many meetings she was in and how influential she was on his political thinking, his strategic thinking. She is a very, very smart woman, Landra Reid. She's so shy, just preternaturally shy, then she had no public presence whatsoever. But when she spoke in these meetings, it had weight. And one of the stories I tell in the book, and it's one of my favorite stories about Harry Reid that I did not know, is Harry Reid was going to vote to confirm Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court until Landra essentially talked him out of it very shortly before the vote. She had a huge influence on him and on his position on immigration, she changed him as well, talking about how her parents probably came to the country illegally, escaping anti-Semitism in Europe. And so she had tremendous influence on him. But the other thing you can't underestimate, and all his staff talked about this, and even people like Chuck Schumer, whom I interviewed, talked about this. He absolutely adored her more than life. And she had some real health challenges during his when he was alive. And he would be incredibly affected when she was in a couple of car accidents. She had Crohn's disease for much of her life. She's still alive, by the way. And she did three interviews with me. She finally forgave me, I guess, for everything. But she was actually really, really great to gain insight into things that I wouldn't have had otherwise. But that was true love. I mean, it really was true love. And her influence on him cannot be overestimated.
When I think of Harry Reid's legacy, I think of the Reid machine. I think that's what most politicos would think about, especially here in Nevada, is just the political apparatus that he created around himself between up-and-coming Democrats, between the unions, between trades, really just a whole system and network of support for Democratic candidates. I got to ask, you know, we are now 10 years post his retirement, 5 years after his death almost. And we've seen in the last two election cycles, CCEA and Culinary start to show signs that they're not necessarily in lockstep with Democrats anymore, that the progressive groups and the Democratic groups or more moderate groups are fracturing. Is the Marine machine still active or is it starting to collapse?
It's a great question, Paul. And while you're correct about those groups that you're talking about not being as in lockstep or part of the cogs of the Reid machine necessarily anymore, reliable cogs, at least those organizations have changed a lot too. They've changed leadership. They've changed their outlook. They've changed their priorities. What has not changed is the people who run the Reid machine. Rebecca Lamb, who is his political lieutenant and who came up through the ranks of the Democratic Party, has been the biggest political force for Harry Reid and for erecting the Reid machine. And she was willing to hire a really, really great young talent, names that most people do not know. So the infrastructure was there even after Reid passed away. And their success record speaks for itself, except for 2014. Since 2008, they have had a remarkable record. And even at the first election after Reid died in 2022, people point to Joe Lombardo beating the Democratic incumbent Steve Sisolak, very close race. But if you look at what happened down the ballot, the Democrats still did pretty well. And that is true even in 2024 when Donald Trump broke the string of Democrats winning that had lasted since 2008. So the Reid machine is still there. It's not funded the way it used to be because Reid, no one could raise money like Reid. And no one reveled in raising money like Reid. But they have found ways around that. There are things called nonprofits and C4s and the like that have been integrated into the Reid machine. It's not the same, clearly. And Nevada has changed. And the Republicans are copycats. And they've done a lot of things that the Reid machine has done. And the Lombardo machine itself has become a formidable force. And it'd be really interesting to see in 2026 and then in 2028, whether the Democrats can hold their own. Remember, the demographics of the state have changed, too. During a lot of that time, because of what the Reid machine did, they did a lot of different things. They registered voters. They got voters out. And Reid was a gatekeeper of who ran and who didn't run. So they had quality candidates for most important races. That it's harder for them to do that last part of it now without Reid being the enforcer that he was. And so the state is now, you know, profoundly purple. It might have leaned blue up until 2016 because of the Reid machine. It doesn't anymore. The voter registration is almost equal between Republicans and Democrats. And there's been this explosion of non-major party voters, which have been difficult for both parties to get a handle on. But I think Lombardo, that's the reason that he won in 2022. They figured at least part of it out. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens in 2026 when that's going to be a huge factor in who wins that race.
John Ralston, thank you so much.
Thank you.
With the holidays just behind us and community cat breeding season on the horizon, Nevada's ongoing problem of pet shelter overcrowding is only likely to worsen. Here to talk about how they're dealing with it are Lori Heeren, Executive Director of the Nevada Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, and Joanna Moritz, owner of Fur and Featherworks in Reno. Joanna and Lori, thank you so much for being on State of Nevada.
Of course. Good morning, Heidi.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, welcome. So, Lori, I want to start with you. The Nevada SPCA has kind of taken a novel approach to the perennial problem of pets offered as holiday gifts that the recipient may or may not have wanted this year. What's been your strategy?
So shelter intake has outpaced adoptions for years, but especially so, Heidi, since the pandemic with economy. Prices are so expensive that there are so many pet owners that cannot afford their pets. And I just recently saw a statistic that said 1 in 8 pet owners in the country have had to give up a pet. So Nevada SPCA, while we've always been a safety net for pets, either from owners relinquishing them or transfers from other shelters, our real focus these days is community support and offering people resources, food and veterinary assistance, so that if they want to keep that pet, and we will provide that financial resource so that we can keep those pets in the homes. We started our food pet pantry in 2020 during the pandemic. We started our community support in 2023. Last year, we paid over $300,000 for people's veterinary assistance to keep pets where they belong with the owners that love them.
And how's that working out?
Very well. Our community support manager, Blake, does follow-ups to make sure that pet stays in the home. And it's been, there's a 99% success rate. And you know, Heidi, there just aren't a lot of outlets in town where you can receive free veterinary assistance. You know, low cost and affordable is one thing, but we have people that don't even have $100 next week to feed their family. So they do not have the resources even for a basic exam and vaccinations, let alone if they're faced with an expensive procedure, a surgery, $1,500, $2,000 or more. And that's where we're able to jump in and assist these people. And our goals for 2026 is to raise that number to $500,000.
So more support than punishment, it sounds like. And we just have seen the warmest December in Las Vegas. That means, as you mentioned, kitten season never ends. Talk about how specific strategies for combating this problem.
So kitten season is another word for feline breeding season. And Heidi, the cats breed when the weather is warm. So unlike other parts of the country, I grew up in a farm in South Dakota. We started getting kittens in May and we were done in September. But in Nevada, with our warmth, we see kitten season while there's a surge in the spring. This year we saw kittens being born all year long. So as much as we enjoy those balmy temperatures in December, it created more kittens on the street. We don't have a lot of resources for the wonderful trappers who go out there and trap the feral cats, spay and neuter them, and return them to the field. I always ask in my conversations with government jurisdictions if there could be more support, financial support, for the people that do that. It is estimated that there are 250,000 feral cats on the streets. And when kitten season happens, I mean, last year, Nevada SPCA took in almost 700 kittens, and we're just one of many, many organizations in town that assist with that. And also, sadly, Heidi, while kittens are very cute, a lot of them come to us in not very good shape. So kudos to all the wonderful trappers out there, the C5s and all those organizations. And Nevada SPCA does what we can to assist them. And I really implore anybody else to support the trappers.
Yeah. So, and Joanna from Fur and Featherworks, I'm going to bring you in here too. Has the change in the weather had the same effect in Reno where you're based? Or is it still cold enough in the winter that you're seeing something of a reprieve from that kitten season that Lori was talking about?
So I might be the wrong person to ask because I am not deeply connected with cat rescue or cat sheltering. However, it has been unseasonably warm here in Reno. I think it's actually supposed to hit 60 degrees today, which is very unusual for us. We usually do have a cold winter. So I would assume that, yes, probably. Yeah, they probably are breeding, and we probably are seeing a very strange kitten year.
So moving more towards your area of expertise, for people who have recently adopted a cat or kitten or are sheltering them, what are some of the most important things they need to know?
I would say two big things. So if you have adopted a kitten, as trainers, we would like everyone to know that cats can be trained and socialized, and it is just as important to train and socialize a kitten as it is a puppy. And the reason I say that is, you know, on the training side, you know, we are most concerned with keeping owned animals in their homes and out of shelters. We don't ever, once they hit a good home, we don't ever want them to see the inside of a shelter. And a lot of kittens and cats are unfortunately relinquished due to behavior problems like aggression or inappropriate elimination, litter box problems. And a lot of that stuff can actually be prevented in kittenhood with proper training and socialization. So getting cats used to, you know, seeing other animals. Do you have a friend or a family member with a dog who is really good with cats that you could introduce your kitten to? And then, you know, can you introduce your kitten to some children? Can you introduce your kitten to some men wearing big hats? You know, all of those things that might be fear triggers for an animal who's never met one before. You can socialize your kitten to those things, and then that prevents behavior problems later on down the road, exactly the way it does in puppies.
Yeah, I think people don't usually think about socialization in a cat, but what you're describing sounds like, it would really help down the road.
We work with cats a lot, and unfortunately, most of the time when people call us for cat training, it's because there's already a really big problem. And no offense, we love to meet you and we love to meet your cats, but if we could just prevent ever having to meet you 2 or 3 years down the road, we would love to do that. We don't want you to have to. And if you've adopted an adult cat, I think the one thing to keep in mind is, you know, as we're working with these cats with behavior issues, I would say the number one common denominator exacerbating factor in all cat behavior issues is boredom. House cats are bored out of their dang minds. And, you know, you've taken this animal that evolution has designed to hunt and sleep and hunt and sleep and hunt and sleep and play and breed and hunt and sleep and communicate with pheromones with its, you know, conspecifics on a farm. And then we keep them in an apartment and we wonder why they go a little nuts. So really keeping in mind, keep your cat entertained and busy. Keeping in mind lots of enrichment, honestly, giving a cat lots to do with their brain and body will prevent a lot of behavior problems.
Yeah, and I want to come back to you, Lori. Other than kitten season, which as we've discovered is no longer kitten season but kitten year, what else are you preparing for coming up this spring as weather gets warmer?
So our biggest focus, again, is providing veterinary assistance and really growing that program. And then, of course, getting ready for the kitten season. And you know, back to the community support, I will say that we make it very turnkey for people to reach out to us. We remove all the barriers. We don't ask questions about your financial situation. We don't ask you to apply for care credit to show us that you won't qualify. We know that there's a lot of people out there that are proud, and we don't want to put them into an embarrassing situation. And we also want them to trust that we are a reliable resource for them. So, Heidi, I encourage people to go to our website. You could fill out a medical application. You can email our program, and then we can jump in. And our community support manager is very knowledgeable about veterinary care. And we find we work with a number of veterinary partners throughout the valley. And then we find the right fit for a veterinarian as to the level of care, availability. You know, of course, price in our end, we always are looking for the best prices just to make sure that we can impact as many animals with our resources, which are all donated by the community. So that really is our largest focus. Of course, we'll always have a lot of adoptions and wonderful animals, kittens, cats, you name it, available for adoption.
And I'm so sorry, Lori. That's I'm okay. going to have to jump in and stop it there. Lori is the executive director of the Nevada SPCA, and Joanna Moritz, that we heard from earlier, is a pet trainer and the owner of Fur and Featherworks. Lori and Joanna, thank you both so much for joining us here.
You're welcome. Thanks thank you, Heidi.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. But to talk about a few of the best options is KNPR's Mike Prevett, who oversees the arts and culture beat for us here at Nevada Public Radio. Hello, Mike.
Hey, Heidi.
So we're coming up on the first holiday weekend of the year. I mean, second, if you celebrated an extended New Year's, and who didn't? But it's Martin Luther King Jr. weekend, and I understand there is a whole week of activities planned in commemoration.
Yeah, it's actually more like a week plus. And, you know, it seems like a good year to remind people of Dr. King's messages about justice, equality, and humanity, of course. The aforementioned week plus starts this Thursday. It goes through till next Saturday, the 24th, and there are several events that pretty much encompass every corner of the Vegas community and business world that you could imagine. The marquee event, of course, is the birthday parade on 4th Street downtown. It's the 44th edition, in fact. The grand marshals of that parade will be the North Las Vegas Chief Judge Belinda T. Harris and ACLU Executive Director Attar Hezbollah.
Who is a frequent guest on State of Nevada, I would like to add.
He sure is. And he and everyone else will be there at 10 a.m. on Monday. That's the actual holiday. Mm-hmm. And then there's several community events from there. You've got panel discussions, including one at the new West Las Vegas Library. That's on this Thursday. You've got a food truck and community resource festival. That's on Saturday at the historic Westside School. There are a couple of worship events. There's an award show that honors Clark County students. There's a jazz fundraiser that helps fund the group that puts these very events on. In fact, we'll just put a link to all of these events at KNPR.org.
Yeah, that's definitely more than a typical holiday weekend. It sounds like so much. Let's move from those community events to a specific author appearance. And it's a local author at that, if I'm right.
Alexandra McCollum is, in fact, a local author, and their debut book came out just this week. It's called Into the Midnight Wood. This is a queer romance novel.
Ooh.
Now, queer romance is kind of all the rage right now because of the HBO Max heated rivalry TV show and the Game Changer series that they are adapted from. But this is more of a fantasy-based romance story. One of the characters is a cisgender gay male, and the other is a non-binary pansexual one. They're roommates. They have opposite dispositions. And the threat here is not just rising romantic tension.
Which I'm sure neither person is acknowledging.
Not at this point in the story. But that's not even the worst of their problems. It's actually the wood area that's close to where they live, and it's threatening to drive at least one of them out of the house. Huh. And I think this is where the fantasy element and then the steamy romantic element begin to play out. Into the Midnight Wood is published by Penguin Random House. This is a pretty big release, and Alexandra is kicking off their book launch tour Friday, January 16th at Writer's Block, where they'll be reading, and then they'll have a chat with local Justin Ross, who leads the Queer as Book Club at Writer's Block.
Oh, that sounds so fun, and we love good synergy here. So you've been painting quite a picture, but we're going to go ahead and move on to a literal picture, or I guess a painter, that is. Tell me about the Van Gogh Show.
I'm not sure if I can accurately do that, but I'm going to try with what few facts I've cobbled together and little things I've seen about what seems like a pretty mysterious show. This comedic play slash performance artist piece is by acclaimed performer, social practice artist, and writer Donna Amlagata.
Wow.
And Donna is Vincent Van Gogh, who is holding court at some onstage happening, and it involves both the audience and then these live painters that surround him. And Vincent, who is boasting a very red beard and a bloodied head bandage, is largely pontificating about fame, the value of art, and the mission of the artist, as assisted by their onstage copy of The Artist's Way by Julian Cameron, if you all remember that book.
So the image of Vincent Van Gogh that we all have in our heads doing things that are completely unexpected. And as soon as you said The Artist's Way, I knew there was going to be some comedy involved.
Donna's Vincent seems a little insecure from what little I've seen of the performance, maybe a little drunk. Vincent is seeking validation that, as most of us know, didn't really come to Van Gogh during his lifetime. He was poor. He was toiling in relative obscurity. One clip that Donna posts on her website has her Vincent personifying each of the potatoes in his Still Life with Potatoes painting that's projected on screen. That alone is worth the price of admission.
Okay, what are the details of that?
So it's Tuesday, January 20th, 8 p.m. at Vegas Theater Company. This ticket is only $6.49.
Wow.
Which, per the segment at the beginning of this program, may or may not offset the parking you'll now have to pay at the adjoining Arts Square lot.
Let's not go back to that. So that is all the time that we have for this week. Mike, thank you so much.
Thanks, Heidi.